This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for March 26th to April 1st. On this week's show, there's a little whitewashing going on, a historic moment in hip-hop, some important birthdays and deaths, and we discuss what happened on April Fool's Day. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. They say that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I say that it's the sincerest form of plagiarism. It's been going on for centuries. Some people actually believe that William Shakespeare's plays were written by another guy, Sir Francis Bacon. There's the now weekly lineup, of course, of copyright infringement lawsuits, some legit and some nothing more than a pure money grab, let's be honest. Imitation, or just flat-out stealing, gets very complicated when it comes to racial matters. What is one person's money-making opportunity or even love and appreciation for the medium is another person's cultural appropriation. Swing music grew out of the early era jazz, which had been consumed by mainly black audiences. Benny Goodman brought it to the white kids, and it grew into a cultural phenomenon. The general public apparently didn't know about twerking until Miley Cyrus did it on the MTV Video Music Awards. Twerking, for the record, has been a part of black culture for centuries, mind you. Since the beginning of rock and roll, when Cleveland disc jockey Alan Freed realized that white kids were buying R&B records from black artists and started playing those artists on his radio show, record labels have had white artists singing songs in genres that were mainly part of the black community in order to make money for themselves. Not for the people who originally wrote or sang the songs, mind you. For instance, Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton was a hit in the black community until Elvis Presley got it and then turned it into a smash hit in the general public. Pat Boone owes almost his entire career to singing Little Richard songs, taking songs like Tutti Frutti and turning them into hits on the pop charts, for instance. This next example, though, is considered the first time that this actually happened in the rock era. In 1954, Hank Ballard released the single Work With Me, Annie. The song went to number one on the R&B charts, but never got to the pop singles charts. That's because the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, considered the song too dirty for white audiences. Not for black ones, but for white ones. So, what did they do? They ended up banning it. That song spawned what many called answer songs, or songs that responded to the original song with the same music for those who couldn't actually figure out what answer songs were all about. In one of those answer songs, there was one called The Wallflower, which was nicknamed Roll With Me Henry by Miss Etta James, the legendary one and same. The FCC considered this song fine for black audiences again, but not for white ones. The song was a huge hit on the R&B chart, staying at number one for four straight weeks. It never made it to the pop charts, at least not in its original form. Enter Miss Georgia Gibbs. Georgia was a jazz singer who was on a bunch of radio shows such as Your Hit Parade and the Tim and Irene Show. Her first hit single on the pop chart came in 1950 when she released If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake. Honestly, I only remember that song as a song on The Muppet Show. Who knew it was actually a legit pop song? But I digress. In the 1950s, Gibbs enjoyed a nice career singing standards that went up the pop charts like Seven Lonely Days, Kiss of Fire, and Simple Melody. In 1955, someone at Gibbs's record label, Mercury Records, had an idea. What if they reworked the song Roll With Me Henry and watered it down, changing the lyrics that the FCC deemed offensive? They reworked the song and changed the title to Dance With Me Henry. On March 26, 1955, Dance With Me Henry entered the pop chart and became a huge hit for Gibbs. That started the trend of what we now know today as whitewashing, at least in music. Whitewashing in movies has been going on ever since the motion picture was invented, but that's for a whole other podcast. Although Dance With Me Henry was the first of these whitewashed songs to make the pop charts, it certainly wasn't the last, even for Gibbs. In 1954, Laverne Baker had a hit song called Tweedledee, which was already lighter in tone so it could gain popularity on the pop charts. Baker's version hit number 14 on that chart. In 1955, Gibbs took the exact same song note for note, used the same musicians who recorded Baker's version, and even tried to get the same producer and engineer. Gibbs's note for note version of Baker's song went to number 2. In this day and age, if someone blatantly stole someone's song, they'd face a huge lawsuit. In 1955, however, this practice of whitewashing, or flat-out stealing, wasn't illegal. Baker tried to even get her congressman to initiate legislation to make the practice illegal, but nothing actually came of it in Baker's case. Baker was so upset at Gibbs at one time that before a flight to Australia, she took out a life insurance policy on herself. The main beneficiary was Gibbs, who Baker wrote to saying, quote, "You need this much more than I do because if anything happens to me, you're out of business," end quote. Ouch. Gibbs herself said that she had no choice but to sing what was put in front of her. There is some truth to that, as vocalists were under a version of the studio system as actors were back then. As it was, Gibbs continued to have success until the late 1950s. To this day, the practice in music continues, but now it's with personality instead of music. Think Vanilla Ice trying to say that he was from the hood and grew up on the streets in order to appeal to the hardcore hip-hop crowd back in the day, when he was actually from a wealthy Dallas suburb. Or, if you want to get a little bit closer in time, how about Australian Iggy Azalea faking a black southern accent in order to sell records in America? Cultural appropriation is in a new phase, you might say. There have been arguments made that the whitewash songs made the original songs more popular and made the original songwriters money. Well, that's not exactly true, because the copyright laws at the time weren't geared towards anybody except for the record labels making that kind of royalty. That same argument was made when hip-hop gained steam, when people questioned sampling other artists, especially James Brown and George Clinton. For the record, if you sample someone's music, pay the royalty to them, please. They are the ones who came up with it, actually. Be nice. Georgia Gibbs's whitewash version of Etta James's song Roll With Me Henry first hit the pop charts and started the whitewashing trend in pop music on March 26th, 1955. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcast. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Before I go on to the next story, we have an honorable mention, the first of many. On March 31st, 1943, a different kind of musical premiered on Broadway. This musical started off with a slow song instead of a rousing opening number like most musicals of that time. It was the first musical to incorporate the singing and dancing into the storyline instead of playing up the music as an interruption or for laughs like other musicals. It was the first musical featuring the collaboration of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II instead of Rodgers and his longtime partner Lorenz Hart, who by that time had developed such a drinking problem that he was no longer able to work. The musical, Oklahoma, which premiered on Broadway on March 31st, 1943. This next story concerns a song that became the first rap song to hit number one on the Billboard singles chart, and it was done by a group whose lead singer was a white woman. Now, I know what you're thinking. After that whitewashing story, is this just another example? No, it is not. See, to me, whitewashing is when it's done to make a quick buck or two, especially from a record label standpoint. However, if you love and show love to the music by respecting the music, then you're not whitewashing it. See Adele or Eminem or Tina Marie or George Michael, who no one would ever consider to be whitewashing the music because you can tell they have a genuine love for the music and are just singing what they love. You can consider these next guys part of that group. In 1980, the group Blondie was recording a new album. They decided that they would stretch their musical boundaries on this one after a few years of being one of the breakout groups from the East Village CBGB's punk rock scene in New York City, along with the Ramones, Patti Smith, Iggy Pop, and the Talking Heads. They experimented with jazz, blues, reggae, funk, disco, and rap. The album that came out of all this experimenting was called Auto American, which was recorded over 2 months in Los Angeles, California. There were only two songs that were released from it at the time. The first was a cover of the 1967 reggae song The Tide Is High. That song hit number one on the pop charts on January 31, 1981. The second song released was a mixture of funk and disco and had lead singer Debbie Harry doing a rap about the man from Mars. The rap also name-checked Fab Five Freddy, who is a hip-hop rapper pioneer and was the very first host of the weekly edition of the MTV show Yo MTV Raps back in the 80s. The rap also name-checked DJ Grandmaster Flash of Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, who had the iconic hip-hop songs The Message and White Lines. The music video is almost as historic as the song. The dancer in the white suit was dancer and choreographer William Barnes. Graffiti artist Lee Quinones made a cameo appearance along with Fab Five Freddy. Grandmaster Flash was supposed to be the DJ in the video, but he couldn't make the music video shoot. He was replaced by artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. The video became the first rap video that was ever played on MTV. The song was released on January 12, 1981. On March 28, 1981, the song became the first rap song to hit number one on the pop charts. The song that shouted out two hip-hop pioneers and rapped about the man from Mars eating cars, Blondie's smash hit single Rapture, which hit number one on March 28, 1981. There are so many important birthdays this week that we actually had to split them up into male and female. So, as always, ladies first. This artist was born on March 27th. There's some dispute as to whether that was March 27th, 1969 or March 27th, 1970. Guess it depends on who you go with. She is one of the biggest selling artists of the past 30 years. She first burst onto the music scene with her debut album in 1990. She's had countless hits along the way, along with a number of publicized love affairs, marriages, and an extremely publicized mental breakdown, which people made fun of at the time, but really should not have. Her singing style, which includes notes that only dogs can hear, has been copied so much that vocal coaches blame her for vocalists ruining their vocal cords trying to emulate her. The woman who gave us the songs of Vision of Love, Someday, One Sweet Day, We Belong Together, along with the most popular Christmas song of the last 30 years, All I Want for Christmas Is You. The Queen of Christmas, Miss Mariah Carey, born March 27th, 1969 or 1970, depending on who you talk to. I'm assuming Mariah likes 1970. It shaves a year off. This next lady was born on March 30th, 1968. She was a teenage singing sensation, at least in French-speaking countries, having made a number of French-speaking records in the 1980s. Her first English-speaking album was Unison in 1990. It was then that she started gaining an international following. She's done a couple of residencies at Caesar's Palace, but she hit her career peak in the late 1990s when she sang the theme song to that movie about a boat that hit an iceberg and then just went down in 2 hours. The song and the movie that went with it won a number of Academy Awards. The woman who sang Power of Love, Love Can Move Mountains, and that theme song from the movie Titanic, My Heart Will Go On, Miss Celine Dion, the legend, born March 30th, 1968. Stefanie Joanne Angelina Germanotta was born on March 28th, 1986. After going to the Tisch School for the Arts in New York University, she dropped out to pursue her dream. She got a contract with Def Jam Records, who dropped her soon thereafter. Stupid mistake on their part. Because she then signed with Sony Records as a songwriter. And it was there that she met the guy who would help her the most to become famous at that point, singer Akon. He signed her to a recording contract instead of a songwriting one and guest starred on her debut single. Since her debut, she's become one of the biggest selling artists of all time, a winner of multiple Grammy Awards, an Academy Award for Best Song, and a trend-setting artist who changes her styles on a whim, much like David Bowie. Stefanie Germanotta, the woman who gave us Just Dance with Akon, Poker Face, Born This Way, among many, many other hits by now, and who also goes by the stage name Lady Gaga. Born March 28th, 1986. Now, to the men. This musician was born on March 31st, 1955 in Scotland. In the mid-1960s, his family moved to Australia in order to escape a brutal winter. Makes sense, it's warm at that point down there. There, he learned how to play the guitar. At the age of 18, both he and his brothers formed a band. They named the band after something they saw on the back of their sister's sewing machine. The band had 5 hit albums with their original lead singer, and they had their biggest album right after their lead singer's death. That album, made as a tribute to him, became the second biggest selling album of all time worldwide, right behind Michael Jackson's album Thriller. The musician tried many stage costumes before settling on an English schoolboy uniform. The man whose band gave us Back in Black, For Those About to Rock, Who Made Who, Hell's Bells, and countless other hard rock classics, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame guitarist Angus Young of AC/DC, born March 31st, 1955. This next artist was born March 30th, 1945. He joined his first band when he was 17 years old. He is ranked 2nd on Rolling Stone's list of greatest guitarists of all time, right behind Jimi Hendrix. He is the only artist to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 4 times. Once for his solo career and a few more times with other groups. He is influenced mainly by the blues. He is the former member of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees, the Yardbirds and Cream, along with Blind Faith and Derek and the Dominoes. He is the man they called Slow Hand. He is 4-time Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Eric Clapton, born March 30th, 1945. Stanley Kirk Burrell was born March 30th, 1962. When he was a kid, he was a bat boy for the Oakland Athletics baseball team. It was during this time that he got his stage name due to him looking a lot like a famous baseball player at the time. During high school, he tried out for the San Francisco Giants, but he didn't make the cut. He went to college for a time and then ended up joining the United States Navy. Once he got out of the Navy, he went into music, forming a Christian hip-hop group called the Holy Ghost Boys. That group is credited with having the first Christian rap hit called The Wall. He then went solo and got a record deal. Between 1988 and 1998, he was one of the biggest-selling artists. His album, Please Hammer, Don't Hurt Them, is the fourth biggest-selling rap album of all time, with the Beastie Boys at number three and two Eminem albums taking the one and two slots. The man, who was nicknamed after Hammering Hank Aaron, MC Hammer, born March 30th, 1962. There is one passing to discuss and two others that are important, but we will not discuss this week. I'll explain in a minute. First, let's get to the passing that we will discuss. This artist was born on November 16th, 1873. His father was a pastor and thought that musical instruments were evil. Despite that, the son played guitar and then organ before settling in on cornet. When he was older, he taught music for a hot second until he realized how little he was making, so he quit and got a non-music job. During his off time, though, he formed a small orchestra and started traveling up and down the Mississippi River. It was then that he fell in love with the Delta Blues. He started studying it and reworking it a little. Then he formed another band and settled in Memphis, Tennessee, where he played in clubs on Beale Street. His arrangements of Delta Blues songs earned him the nickname the Father of the Blues. He is credited with bringing the blues to the general public long before the legendary Robert Johnson became popular. He is W.C. Handy, who passed away at the age of 84 on March 28, 1958. Now, I debated whether I was going to discuss the way that these next two people passed away. However, with both of their birthdays coming up in mere days, I decided to discuss them at that point. I will, however, briefly mention them now since their deaths happened on this week. On April 1, 1984, during an argument with his father and only one day before his 44th birthday, singer Marvin Gaye was shot and killed by his father. We will discuss his life and also his death on next week's in-depth podcast. On March 31, 1995, right as she was on the cusp of international superstardom, the woman nicknamed the Queen of Tejano Music, Tejano singer Selena, was shot and killed by the former president of her fan club, who Selena and her family had caught stealing money from them. Selena's birthday is on April 16th, so we will discuss her life and also her death 2 weeks from now on that week's edition of the In-Depth Podcast. Finally, to wind things down on a better note, April 1st is known as April Fool's Day. A few historical things of note happened that day, including more than a few pranks. For starters, it is the birthday of classical composing great Sergei Rachmaninoff, who was born in 1873. Also, blues great Alberta Hunter, who was born in 1895. And entertainer, and also the mother of Carrie Fisher, Miss Debbie Reynolds, was born in 1932. The father of ragtime music, pianist and composer Scott Joplin, passed away on April 1, 1917, at the age of 48. The aforementioned Marvin Gaye's death on April 1, 1984, we already very briefly touched upon and will again on next week's podcast. Both singer-songwriter Adam Schlesinger of the group Fountains of Wayne, along with jazz musician Ellis Marsalis, who was the father of musicians Branford and Wynton Marsalis, passed away on April 1st, 2020, both of them passing away from COVID-19, as did a lot of musicians at that point. Also, on April 1st, 1996, on his birthday no less, MC Hammer filed for bankruptcy protection. If you see one of the MTV or VH1's Behind the Music episodes on him, you'll understand that whole thing. April 1st was, strangely, a big day in the life of John Lennon and his immediate family. For instance, in 1964, John Lennon reunited with his father, Freddie Lennon, who he hadn't actually seen in 17 years as his pops ran out on him. In 1970, John Lennon and Yoko Ono played an April Fool's joke on the media, telling them that they were both getting sex change operations. In 1973, John Lennon and Yoko Ono formed their own country and called it Newtopia. That's a good joke. I like that one. In 1976, John's father, Freddie, passed away at the age of 63. And on April 1st, 2015, John's first wife, Cynthia Lennon, who is the mother of his first son, Julian Lennon, passed away at the age of 75. Perhaps the best thing about April 1st is all of the April Fool's Day jokes. Musically, quite possibly the biggest April Fool's Day joke is one that still continues to this very day, and it doesn't even have to be April Fool's Day to enjoy it. On April 1st, 2008, YouTube played a practical joke on people by replacing videos with Rick Astley's iconic music video of his huge hit, Never Gonna Give You Up, creating the very first Rickroll, a trend that's now been done to death by way too many people. Please stop it. Just please, please, please stop doing that. Anyway, happy April Fool's Day, everybody. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for March 26th to April 1st. Thanks for listening.